Motherhood has a lot of different forms these days, and it's a very interesting area of law where reproduction rights and the law merge. One in five married couples struggle to conceive. 42% of all American adults say they have used or know somebody who has used fertility treatments. It's a process that has some legal ramifications and needs some navigation. And with us is one of Chicagoland area's premier reproductive rights lawyers, Ryan Ferranti. He advises intended parents and donors, gestational carriers, all parties to the assisted production process in what the law is and how to protect themselves. Ryan, thank you so much for joining us. Hi, Ryan.
It's great to be with you.
So, you know, you say in your website that your family has utilized these services. So you come to this issue by virtue of having gone through it yourself. Can you just share with our listeners briefly the process that you went through with your wife?
Of course. I, as you mentioned, Karen, I am a collaborative reproduction attorney here in Chicago, or assisted reproductive technology attorney, or any of the other number of names that you might hear used to describe the work that I do. And I did not come to this practice of law by accident. I began my career as a, after law school, as a corporate tax attorney. And it was during that time that my wife and I battled infertility for many years before we resolved that infertility with the help of the most wonderful gestational surrogate that any intended parents could ask for. And so while we were overcoming the challenges of infertility, I pivoted my career as a lawyer from tax to working with families like ours, whether it be individuals or couples engaging in egg donation, sperm donation, and most prominently in my practice, gestational surrogacy.
Interesting. So, and I do see lawyers who pivot for the very reason you're talking about. They have a situation, whether it's a special needs child or something, they have to navigate the system themselves, and then they realize, hey, I can help other people do what I had to do. So very, very interesting. So if people are going through infertility treatments, and I'm just going to talk generally, at what point do they need a lawyer? Will they need a lawyer? And will that be the first stop? Or will the doctor's office or the clinics be the first stop?
It's a great question. It's a question I get every single day. An individual or a couple would first go to a physician or a fertility clinic for an assessment of infertility to determine the best path forward. Every situation is a little bit different. For me and my wife, when we were trying to understand why we couldn't achieve a pregnancy, we first sought the advice of a reproductive endocrinologist here in Chicago. For us, the first step in the plan, which is very common, is to not attempt medical intervention. It's a really romantic timed intercourse. And when that solution is unsuccessful, the physician is going to recommend a number of other solutions, which could include IVF.
Okay. And when that happens, I imagine there are contracts, correct?
Yes, there are releases that are signed with the clinic. We are, at this point, my wife and I are dealing with just the clinic. And so the clinic is going to have any patient sign informed consent forms, which is a legal document detailing the risks and the benefits and the alternatives to procedures like IVF or egg freezing or donor sperm use. It just confirms that the patients understand the potential outcomes, including the success rates, and also contemplation of the future disposition of the material that's retrieved for the process.
And, you know, and to some extent, those are probably like typical medical waivers when you're acknowledging, you know, the process and the ups and downs of what could happen. Let's talk a little bit about disposal of the, and I'm sure I'm not using the words correctly. You have to correct me if I'm using the wrong syllables here. But what, you know, so you freeze these embryos, and what happens in the event you don't use all the embryos? What happens in the event you're done having children? What happens in the event there's a divorce and there is a dispute as to whether or not these embryos are going to be used?
A really great question, because I spend a lot of my days discussing the future disposition of embryos or eggs or sperm when the patient has no further use for that material. Disposition is a feature of the forms that are signed at the clinic. They're also contemplated in direct agreements between recipients and the donors who are providing the material. So patients like recipient parents or patients like my wife and I who are patients at a fertility clinic, we're making an election on these informed consent forms to dispose of any excess material consistent with our intent at that time. For example, patients can elect to discard the material or donate it to research, in which case the gametes, and when I say gamete, that's either the egg or the sperm or the embryo, in a medical research setting, they would be studied and used to advance the science, but not to try to create life.
We are here today talking about reproductive rights in honor of Mother's Day. Ryan Ferrante is practices in this area. Ryan, we are having some problems dropping you here, or you're dropping us, but you're answering the question, which is, okay, so you have these embryos that you've created with your significant other, and maybe you're breaking up now, and what do you do if there is a dispute as to what actually happens with the embryos?
Great question. When a couple breaks up, I think this is where we left off, those frozen embryos or the frozen gametes, the egg or the sperm, are generally disposed of or donated to research or awarded to one partner based on those informed consent forms that were signed with the clinic prior to the medical procedures. If no contract exists, courts may more often rule in favor of the party wishing to avoid procreation. In most states, though, and this was a hot topic in the last few years at the very least, embryos are not considered people or simple property, but a unique category requiring mutual consent for use.
It would seem to make sense that if, you know, you have good intentions of staying together forever and ever, like most people, but if you break up, you know, I would imagine that most people would not want to take an embryo and then have to pay, you know, to raise a child who you're not involved with. I mean, are you telling me that the judges will normally, in the absence of a clear contractual provision, will say, you know, no, you can't use that to get pregnant?
I think this is
likely. Oh, gosh.
Something that I work on quite regularly is where there is a separation between the parties. One party can donate the material to the other, even embryos that have been created previously.
They can or they can't? Could you say that again?
Yes, can.
Okay, we're getting
the embryos to the other party.
Okay. All right. So, and I'm not going to get too much into this because we'll get into politics and all of those things. But I do remember that there was at least one state there was a concern that disposing of these embryos might be deemed to be a crime in that the embryos would be deemed to be a person. Is that true?
Yeah. So destroying embryos is not a federal crime in the United States, but legal protections, I think, to your question for embryos vary significantly by state. I think the case that you're specifically referring to was the LePage versus the Center for Reproductive Medicine case in Alabama that was heard by the Alabama Supreme Court, where they ruled that frozen embryos are considered children under the state's Wrongful Death of a Minor Act. This means that individuals and or clinics can be held civilly liable for the accidental or intentional destruction of embryos. But that was tailored to the state of Alabama and not anywhere else.
And, you know, to me, that's just very curious because let's just say that you have five embryos, you choose to have two children, and those embryos then, they have to be kept into perpetuity so as not to create a crime.
There's also ways, you know, you can move the embryos to another state where more disposition options would be available. There's also something referred to as a compassionate transfer, where a transfer of the embryo would occur when they're confident that a pregnancy would not result.
Interesting. Very, very interesting. So let's talk about surrogacy. Can you describe what that means and how that process works?
Of course. gestational surrogacy, there's two types of surrogacy. One is sort of a relic, which is traditional surrogacy, where the woman carrying the child had a genetic connection. Gestational surrogacy is the process, and this is far more common today. This is the process by which a person attempts to carry and give birth to a child created through IVF, in other words, created outside the body, in which the gestational surrogate has made no genetic contribution to any resulting child. And that was how my wife and I now have our two children, was through gestational surrogacy.
Okay, so that means there is a female who donates an egg. Is that fair to say?
No, it would be a couple where the couple has provided the egg and the sperm to create embryos, and then the embryos are then transferred to a third party.
Okay, and so the donors in that case, what rights would they typically have in a case like that? Because this material is obviously their genetic material, but somebody else is carrying the child. Who is actually the parent here? Are there any rights that the donors have?
So donors, if there is a donor involved, where the creation of the embryo can happen in any of a number of ways. It could be two people, like my wife and I, who intend to parent any child that's born as a result of the combination of the egg and the sperm, or there could be another party involved, an egg donor or a sperm donor.
Got it.
And so donors who are providing their gametes for a couple or an individual to be able to create an embryo, they are not recognized as a legal parent under Illinois law. In fact, there's a number of contracts involved here. There's a gestational surrogacy contract, but prior to that, if we're creating embryos with the help of a donor, there would be, most of the time, a direct agreement between the recipients of that material and the donor. And in that contract, the donor is acknowledging that he or she is not a legal parent. They do not have any rights to the child, whether it be parental, legal, custodial, visitation, inheritance rights. All of those are relinquished prior to the providing of the material.
And I guess this may be a little bit out there, but let's just say the child is conceived, everything's great, and at some point the child wants to know who the biological parents are. Would there be a way to do that? And if so, would that need the consent of both parties?
Yes. There's a very lawyerly answer for you. It depends. It depends a lot on the direct agreement between the recipients and the donors. A lot of these arrangements are unidentified, where the parties don't know who the identities of the parties, but they have information about them. Or they could be an open donation arrangement where the party's full names and identities are disclosed to the other party. And future contact is also contemplated in these contracts, not just because a donor conceived person may want to contact the donor, but also out of medical necessity, because medical histories change and there may be information that may be relevant to the donor conceived person in their own treatment.
When you see litigation or you see things go south and you need the court involvement, what are the typical disagreements that arise as a result of some of these procedures?
Embryo disposition, sometimes there are disputes between a couple, amongst a couple, about what should happen to any remaining material. There may be disputes about the forms that they were signed. Were they ambiguous in the original clinic consent forms? And I think the biggest issue that we see in this space is the varying laws across state lines. Here in Illinois, we have a robust gestational surrogacy statute, whereas some states rely on case law or they're completely silent on the issue. But negligence, breach of contract, informed consent actions, those are the disputes that we most often see. But we have very legally sound contracts between parties and gestational surrogacy arrangements here in Illinois.
What about insurance coverage? I know that there have been issues in the past regarding insurance coverage. Are there laws that require insurance carriers to cover certain procedures?
An excellent, excellent question. Constantly evolving. As of today, there are about 25 states and District of Columbia that mandate varying levels of coverage for infertility diagnosis and treatment. There is no federal mandate. But the timing of this conversation actually is fitting because I am leaving tomorrow morning for Washington, D.C. to meet with members of Congress to garner support for new legislation called the Hope with Fertility Services Act, which aims to address that very issue, which is to mandate nationwide insurance coverage for infertility diagnosis, treatment, and fertility preservation services for patients, for example, cancer patients who want to preserve their fertility before cancer treatment. This advocacy is part of Resolve, which is the National Infertility and Family Building Association's month of action. And the good news here, Karen, is that the HOPE Act already has bipartisan support, which says a lot about how far we've come in our advocacy efforts.
Well, that's great. And so just you're going to be testifying in front of Congress?
Privately with members of Congress and their staff to get co-sponsorship on the Hope for Fertility with Fertility Services Act.
Very, very, very interesting. So let's just talk about how we get in contact with you. Ryan Ferrante, it's F-E-R-R-A-N-T-E. If people need to reach out to you and they would like your advocacy in some of these issues, how would they get a hold of you?
My web address is ryanferrantelaw.com. I also have a very understanding wife. I can give you my phone number. It's 773-251-2287.
And I just have one final question. There was an interesting lawsuit that was filed down in Champaign a little while ago about a woman and a daughter suing a clinic and a deceased doctor who allegedly used his own sperm rather than a donor's for artificial insemination years and years ago. And there's a law in Illinois that has to do with fraud in this process. Can you just tell me briefly, we got literally about 45 seconds, what does that law say and how is this case going to pan out?
Yes, that were the subject of Netflix or some other medium to discuss these cases. But the Illinois Fertility Fraud Act, I believe is what you're referencing,
yes,
that was passed about 3 years ago, and it establishes a civil cause of action against healthcare providers who use their own reproductive cells or material, whether it be the sperm or the eggs, during fertility treatment without the patient's informed consent. I think you might be catching on to a theme here of informed consent with patients in these reproductive actions.
And I'm not even going to go into the question, which is really my question, which is why would any doctor think that he should be using his own? But I guess that's just a question that we should end on a positive note here on Mother's Day, right? But anyway, thank you so much for joining us, Ryan. Ryan Ferrante, one more time, how do we get in touch with you?
RyanFerranteLaw.com.
Could you say that again? You just dropped out again. Go ahead.
Sure. It's my web address is RyanFerranteLaw.com, and you can reach me at 773-251-2287.